Hola de Alicante. This is Leila Benitez-James here again for the Asymptote podcast. Hoping everyone had a wonderful summer and is ready for fall weather. I am. Today we have a special and especially ingenious episode to share with you all. But first, I'd like to remind listeners that if they have not already, they should jump on the Asymptote Book Club, specially curated by our award-winning team based across the world on 6 continents. The Asymptote Book Club is a new way to discover world literature. You can sign up to receive, by post, a new hand-picked fiction title released each month, along with exclusive perks and extras, including discussion groups, and if you sign up now, your first book will ship in October and arrive just in time for curling up in chillier weather. Our guest today is John Keane, translator, writer, graduate fellow of the Cave Canem Writers Workshops, and author of Annotations and Counter Narratives, both published by New Directions, as well as several other works, including the poetry collection Seismosis and a translation of Brazilian author Hilda Hilst's novel Letters from a Seducer. Keane is the recipient of many awards and fellowships. Most recently, this past week, in fact, a MacArthur Genius Award. So I was lucky he was kind enough to connect with me over a Google Hangout amidst all the news. Now, back in June, I had the pleasure of sitting down with translator and writer Lawrence Schimmel in Madrid, and our conversation was, in part, inspired by Keane's essay, Translating Poetry, Translating Blackness, which you can read on the Poetry Foundation's website. It is a must read, and really resonated with a lot of the literary searching I've begun in Spain in these past 4 years of living here. In an effort to read more Black Spanish writers, I have been seeking them out across all mediums and was happy to come across a radio program, Sociedad Anónima, where writer and blogger Desiree Bella Lobede was talking about her recent book, Ser Mujer Negra en España, Being a Black Woman in Spain. Bella Lobede had been pleasantly surprised that just 4 days from its release, the book had sold out and her publishers were having to rush printing of a second edition. She was upbeat and full of joy, but the program also touched on what drove her to write the book in the first place, and she tells of an encounter she had at the age of just 13 when police officers at a bus stop demanded she produce her papers or ID, telling her that the next time they found her without them, she'd be taken to jail. She was so young at the time, she didn't know to tell them her age, as you are only required to carry ID over the age of 14. Aside from that, she was born and raised in Spain, as were her parents, as Equatorial Guinea still pertained to Spain. This history, much of Spain's history, she says, was news to the many people who asked, and still ask her, where she is from and refuse to take Spain as the answer. This is an all too familiar story for many people of color in Spain and throughout the world, myself included. There's a certain lack of knowledge that produces some pretty backwards thinking at best and can have dangerous consequences otherwise. Despite much ignorance being worked against, her grace and optimism was infectious, and I got that same boost from my conversation with Keane. While his essay brought up much in need of work, our conversation highlighted the great strides being made and the absolute joy that is translation and discovering new worlds within words. Have a listen. Thank you so much for joining us at Asymptote podcast, and especially on the heels of such tremendous news. Congratulations. And the first thing I wanted to ask is that as time is so crucial for translators, is this going to open up some time for new translation, or do you have any pending projects that you're in the middle of right now?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for inviting me to participate in the Asymptote podcast, and also thank you for the good words about the award. I mean, I do have some projects that we're working on. I've been working on a little project with Eric Becker. I've discussed projects with translators, some other translators. So, I mean, I think at some point it will open up time and space for me to, to do more translation. Because, of course, yeah, time, it really is of the essence, as you know. But yeah, so I think down the road, it'll definitely make that possible.
And I would like the essay Translating Blackness is really what I'd like to get into. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask about something that I've noticed you say a few times. And I've heard other like writer, translator, poet, translators talk about this as well. And it's that you use translation a lot as a kind of metaphorical way to talk about writing or to talk about the difference between like images and writing. Was it Gaper's Block? There's
Gaper's
an interview
Block,
from
yes.
like 2006. You talked about the difference between writing and the image. Like there was like a bigger gap between the world and the word. Whereas with an image, you don't have that as much. But you talk about it in terms of translation, that the word is a kind of translation. And then in that, for example, in the MacArthur video as well, you talked about like all fiction and all writing be a kind of translation, whether it's between, you know, the outside world and the individual or between individuals. But I've noticed that translators a lot of times who are also writers will then grab that idea of translation to help talk about other genres.
Well, yes. I mean, I feel like, you know, with all art, it entails artistic production. It entails a kind of, you know, it's the base of the word translation is that, as the brilliant poet and translator Nathan Yale once pointed out, we were having a conversation with she came to speak to my students and gave them the etymological breakdown of translation and carrying over the body of the dead. So that process of carrying over something that cannot be brought over, that space is something cultural, something linguistic, an image, something visual, something conceptual that actually does not fully map onto that new target, you know, space of understanding and possibility, is what artists do all the time. I mean, and quite often I think it's, you know, it's unconscious, even when, you know, the artist intends to do certain things or has a very kind of clear outline or structure, there is always a kind of, to use Anne Carson's phrase, a kind of surplus, right? Particularly in the best work, you know, so that's something extra that's produced, right, in that process of carrying over something new, kind of a new possibility opens up. And so I think translation is a very, very powerful metaphor, a very, very powerful figure for thinking about, first of all, of course, art, but also, and what art can do, but also just for human relations, right? Because we're always in the process of translating. We're in the process of making sense of people's expressions and gestures and what they say and how they say it, and which of course brings us into the realm of interpretation. But a key point of interpretation is translation. And when we are unable to understand other people, we don't have the right tools, of course, then, you know, all kinds of problems arise.
Yeah, I love that idea. I hadn't heard the Anne Carson surplus idea.
Well, there's she wrote this, it's a very famous essay, and I believe it's in a version of it may be in Eros the Bittersweet, but there was this essay she wrote that precedes, I believe it was Eros the Bittersweet, or around the time of that really remarkable book. And I think I'm getting the title wrong, but it was something like Poetry, Its Essence. This is a remarkable little essay. And I remember people that I knew, and this was, of course, the time, you know, where people would actually have to photocopy things. It sounds like, you know, like the medieval era or something, but it wasn't even that long ago, the 90s. But people, you know, photocopied it and we sent it around. And then I can't remember if someone scanned it in. Someone may have had a scanner and so scanned in a version of it. But and it might have been, I think it appeared in Three Penny Review. And then, of course, versions of what she was saying started to circulate. And she was talking about poetry and concision, right? When poetry, because it compresses and denses language and meaning, it springs something extra forth. And I think there's a way in which translation does that as well, along with those places and spaces of the untranslatable, right? Things that cannot be captured in another language. I mean, and sometimes, of course, it has to do with, you know, idioms. Sometimes it has to do with things that are very particular to a particular space or culture. And then sometimes it's, you know, sometimes it's just, it's a kind of feeling or mood. I mean, I think of, like, you know, the Portuguese Brazilian saudade, which you don't really have a word, you know, a word in English for. You know, the words that we use are kind of inadequate to saudade.
Yeah.
So, of course, I mean, that means, well, in English, you know, often you just pull the, you know, like schadenfreude or any number of words from other languages, you just pull the word in. But for some reason, saudade has not made it, or saudade, if you're from Port, Portugal. Saudade has not made it into English, but I feel like, you know, it's one of those terms where it's like, it's such a powerful, beautiful, resonant feeling that is so particular across a kind of vast Lusophone linguistic field, and we don't have a word for it. So whenever you encounter, and, you know, as a translator, saudade in a text by a Portuguese language writer, I mean, what do? You know, do you just say, you know, in English, saudade, or do you try to come up with like nostalgia or, you know, deep feeling or whatever term?
Well, and just that, like having all those words that also trigger other ideas, even if they're difficulties. Talking and thinking a little bit about difficulty and being like drawn to translation, how has translation impacted your writing practice? In that essay, you talk a little bit about it being a tether and kind of like a tether to other cultures. You might never think about all of those feelings like being mixed together even in that one word. Like, has it really seeped in? Because you said it's in that essay that you've been translating for over 10.5 years. So at this point, a bit more than that.
Yes, I mean, it's funny because thinking about it, I'm trying to remember, I wrote the essay a few years ago, and at that point, I've been translating. I mean, it's actually been for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think it was published in April of 2016, so 2016, before.
Right, yeah. And that might have been, I think that might have been in response to, you know, part of what I think I was talking about in terms of the temporal span was, mm-hmm. you know, just the Ilsch book, which came out a few years before. But actually, I've been translating for quite some time. And it's always, for me, a learning process. I mean, I think one of the things that when you translate, I feel like it makes you much more aware of the power and possibilities of the language that you're writing in. So your source language or your first language or languages, right? So every time I translate, whether it's actually a formal translation project or reading something online, you know, like sometimes I'll read French newspapers or Portuguese newspapers and trying to make sense of what's, you know, what I'm reading. As I'm doing that, it gives me a deeper sense of the nuances and possibilities of English, right? The complexities of the language that I use every day. And something I think we, you know, often don't think about. I mean, writers should, on a certain level, be thinking about the language that they're working in. But sure, because there's a way in which we can kind of think about it. You know, you look at most things online, and I mean, clearly there are a lot of people, punning and extraordinarily witty people, clever people, smart people, doing amazing things with language, even sometimes in the most simple of formats. So on Twitter, just the wit and inventiveness of people on Twitter always fascinates me. And that, of course, makes me think. That involves a kind of translation. But, you know, but when I'm, let's say, reading a Portuguese newspaper, so reading about the election in Brazil, thinking about, you know, trying to bring it into English, but also, you know, then when I leave that and look at an English language text, it makes me so aware of how English works, right? What are the components of it? And as a writer, I think that's actually, it's a very useful and important and additional bit of training and tool that you have at your disposal, right? Because you realize, I mean, you can do so much more with language than you think you can. And you also realize the power of language, right? To convey ideas, feelings, a world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it made me a little bit more careful and a little less frivolously playful, if that makes sense. Because sometimes I'm thinking, I don't know if you've done this, but as I'm writing in English, sometimes I can't help but think, how would this sound in Spanish, or would it translate well, or are the playful things that I'm doing in English actually serving some larger purpose, or would they just be completely lost in French or Spanish or any other language? And I think it made me a little bit more careful. I don't know, I guess it's always nice to be playful and to play with form and genre as well.
I agree. I would just add, I mean, this is, you just mentioned a very important thing that I, important point that I'm sort of fascinated by, and I've written a little bit about this on my blog. You know, I just sort of think about, and I once had someone challenge me because I think they were saying that I was misinterpreting Tim Parks, which may be the case. But, you know, there's a sort of wave of writers writing, you know, his first language is not English, and they've written, even though they're not writing in English, they're writing in their own source languages in such a way that the work will be more easily translatable into English. I think I maybe mentioned this in the essay. And because they want the work to circulate and they see how powerful English is, okay. And how dominant it is.
Oh, no, I haven't read that. I need to read that.
You know, that's fascinating to me. And what I have always been so interested in is writers who draw upon the unique resources of their, of whatever languages they write in ways that almost defy translation, right? So, you know, I mean, there are, you know, whether it's Giacomo Leopardi, the great Italian writer, who, you know, people always told me he's, you know, a genius, he's great and everything. And, you know, I remember reading some of his poems and they just come out so stilted, right? So to pick another Italian writer who fascinates me, just to stay on Italy, there's the great Italian writer Eugenio Montale. And one of the things that sort of fascinates me about Montale is that Montale is very attuned to the sound of Italian. And in his motets, his motetti, he's got one motetti that always struck me, right? Because it also shows what poetry can do. And it begins, Il fiore che ripeti dall'alborato non scorate di me. So the flower that repeats from the edge of the crevice, forget me not. Okay, so you can hear that, the poetry and the rhythm in English, even in Italian. But in that poem, he has the language. It's not just the words, but the sounds of Italian. It creates a kind of grinding of gears, right? And he's talking about the funicular, right, that goes up the mountain. And I mean, I remember when I read that, I was just astonished because I thought, okay, to translate this, it's not at all about capturing the precise words of this poem. That's part of it. Not even precise words, but the kind of spirit, the idea. But what's also the sonic power, the sonorities of this poem are doing part of the work. And in an Italian listener's ear, they hear those gears grinding because of the conjunction of consonants and vowels. And so in English, you have to find an approximation. But it also suggests that, I mean, there is something very powerful about every language. To me, it's really quite powerful to sort of consider when they're not thinking about, okay, how will this translate into another language? But how can I draw upon the unique resources of the language that I am writing in or thinking in or creating in and make it do these really sort of extraordinary things that the reader doesn't even have to be told are happening because they feel it as well as grasp it intellectually.
Right. Yeah, I love that. So shifting gears slightly, okay. Well, just really getting more into that translating blackness essay. I loved it partly because I'd never seen or I'd never read things just put so succinctly in terms of not just translating, not just the 3% problem, but specifically with writers of color, black writers, LGBTQ writers. And I wanted, I guess, first ask, partly because of what you just said, that like your mind really does shift when you read these new things, new ways of putting in language, and especially bringing that into English, if you can kind of keep that. There was that panel at last year's AWP, but have you seen more change in the kind of translating world after that essay, or more response from people about those specific problems that you were bringing up?
I have. I mean, there were the people in the panel. I mean, I think about, you know, a translator like Tiffany Higgins, for example, or Aaron Coleman, who was also on the panel, or Lauren Schimmel. I mean, I think there are some amazing translators out there, and I mean, they are trying to think about, and I'm, of course, there are many people that I'm not even naming, but I think there are many people who are trying to, first of all, to kind of open up a translation, expand what's being translated, to think about who is doing translations, to think about, you know, expanding the languages that people are working in. I mean, so, you know, going beyond European languages to, you know, the languages of, you know, for example, South Asia,
yeah,
or the languages, you know, of Sub-Saharan Africa, et cetera. You know, I think about, you know, the number of people working in doing translating work coming from Mexico, right? So the Antena folks who are doing just amazing work. John Plucker, you know, was recently, earlier this year, we were having a conversation. We were both down at Stetson. You know, he was talking about the Garifuna writer, Winston Gonzalez. Yeah, I mean, so I think there's this work is happening, and it's very exciting because what you start to see is that you get a richer and richer and richer sense of, you know, the world around you. Things that we sort of see in our everyday life, sort of people we interact with, you know, that have not, that, you know, we know that they're lives are worthy of literature. And of course, there have been people writing about them. But what ends up happening now is, or it's happening now, I think, is that you're seeing people being able to bring the literary, creative, and of course, in the case of films, et cetera, other art forms, bring that work into focus through translation, bring some of these films that are being made that haven't been seen before. I mean, I think it just kind of really sort of enriches and expands our sense and understanding of the world. So I think some really exciting things are happening right now.
Yeah, definitely. I was lucky enough to take a class with JP and with Jen Hoffer. They taught a class in Houston, and like, it was basically an antenna class. And it was,
great.
It changed my whole perspective on a lot of literary aspects and translation and interpretation. And I guess, I mean, it gets a little into that very last footnote on the essay, where it's just not just making everyone recognize that there is a need for all of this, but how do you foster an environment where young Black translators are getting that support, and where translators in general are getting that support for bringing other languages in? Because it is, so much of it has to do with markets and with what different countries think that the US wants to buy, or what they think that England wants to buy. And if they're not seeing that demand for it, they're not going to necessarily encourage it or produce it or publish it. And so that all has to kind of shift together.
I think it's a real challenge. I mean, I was just thinking of, you know, for example, these remarkable translations by Kristen Dykstra of, you know, a number of really important contemporary Afro-Cuban poets. And she's, you know, she's translated a range of poets. But just some of these recent ones. How it deepens of post-revolutionary Cuba, right? What's been happening, how to think about the Cuban special period, just of everyday life, right? And I mean, because there's a kind of intimacy and a power, again, a profound psychic and emotional, affective wealth provides us with a kind of knowledge that we really don't get anywhere else, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe we get it in other places, but, you know, in a very different kind of way. And so I just think about, like, how important that work is. But I mean, whenever I see work, like these beautiful books that she's doing, I think it's just it's a heroic thing that she's doing, but it's also, I mean, for the publisher as well. I mean, because in general, you know, poetry does not sell as much. And of course, it's very hard, I think, you know, there are books in translation in the U.S. that do very well. I mean, you know, you think about Paulo Coelho, you know, it's just, I mean, that all over the world. But, you know, they just, to get American readers to read works in translation is a challenge. I mean, and so, I mean, that's also something I think I'm always cognizant of. But at the same time, as you point out, there is this kind of concurrent challenge for creating the conditions that make it possible for young translators, particularly young translators of color, you know, women translators, LGBTQ translators, Black translators, people who are intersectionally, all of those things, things, you know, to be able to do this work. Because, of course, I mean, you know, you have to live, you need time. Translation is not easy, you know, and you need, I always think translators need opportunities to kind of just even play around and be in conversation with other translators. I mean, learn, to continue learning. So all these things are part. So, I mean, I think there are many, many challenges to it. I mean, and I think I was trying to be cognizant when I was writing that essay that, you know, that rather than hectoring people to say, just go out and do this, the important thing is to also try to figure out ways to help foster the creations to make it possible, or the conditions to make it possible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, after reading it, I was kind of thinking there needs to be a cave canum for translators, that kind of thing. Like, there just needs to be those kinds of, you know, spaces and residencies and all that stuff that just encourages those people to have more space. And because I also saw a really, really great panel. I'm forgetting if it was Penn or which one it was, but it was like, where are all the women in translation? And it was a great panel, but it was like, there was no one who was not white, or I don't know what their orientations were, but it was like, okay, right. There's more than just that question that we should be answering. But I also did see, I mean, I haven't been to an AWP since Seattle, but I noticed that there were many more translation events at Seattle. And then looking at the list from last year, it seemed like there were many panels about translation and specifically about identity and mm-hmm. the translator. I mean, I could see a real shift just in the past 5 years with what they're offering just at that conference.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's things are changing. I mean, you know, I was just thinking of, for example, you know, one of the big books from France this past year was The End of Eddie. And it was, it's received a lot of acclaim, and rightly so. You know, but I was thinking about just our sense, for example, of queer life in France, and particularly the life of young queer working class people. And I was sort of fascinated by the fact that, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s, there were a number of books, particularly by, you know, writers of color. One of the big ones who came to, I mean, now Abdelataye is now quite famous, Moroccan, French. But before Abdelataye, you know, there were people like Rashid O and Jalad. And I thought, you know, how might it have changed just even the discourse around The End of Eddie and this book and this writer, if there had been more translations of these other works, but also by other working class, I mean, you know, let's say white French writers, queer French writers, and these works circulated, people knew about them, so that in fact it were, you know, this book weren't sort of discussed as if it were the first of something, but rather part of a larger conversation. I mean, I think that even happens still even in American literature to a certain degree, and it fascinates me. Of course, we're talking about French, a language that actually, you know, where the number of works translated from French into English and that actually appear on the market is actually pretty sizable. So we're not talking about a language that's really kind of underserved. But even there, if you can, you know, zoom in and focus on this particular component, you see that, you know, the lack of translations really does mean to a certain degree, a different kind of conversation that you can have if people had a better sense of, or deeper, richer sense of, all the other works that sort of preceded this work.
And I was wondering too, just about your translation origins, just in context of the African diaspora, because you talk a little bit in that essay about coming to different languages and your Sanskrit book that you may or may not still have. And I was wondering, like, when did you, because you said it was mostly through books, though. It wasn't from leaving the U.S. And so I was wondering when you first kind of encountered diaspora outside of the United States, or if it surprised you, or if there was any country that you went to that kind of, like, surprised you with the people that were there. Because I know I definitely had, Spain was a surprise to me when I first came. I had an idea of Europe that was, like, from Room with a View, and it just, like, it didn't, they're, like, our people here. There's, like, a lot of our people here.
Right. Well, I mean, I think every place I've traveled has been a surprise and a kind of revelation. You know, I mean, I think, well, just a little anecdote. Before I had ever translated, you know, I had an idea of what, I always have this idea of what other countries it might be like. It's, in one hand, you know, I think it's the good version, and the other hand is the bad version. The good versions would be, oh, it's great, it's like what I've seen in movies, and the bad versions, okay, they're going to be horrible and racist, right? Okay, so the first time, my partner and I, it was 1998, we went to Europe. It was really quite wonderful on so many levels. And so, the first thing that was sort of surprising is, you know, just seeing the large numbers of Black people in Europe, you know, and also people from all over the world. I mean, I think, you know, in Spain, we encountered people from Iran, we found people from Egypt.
Yeah, it's a huge, you know, Chinese person. Population here.
Exactly, and that was 1990.
Oh, yeah.
This was before the Olympics, you know, the Barcelona Olympics. This was just, you know, just meeting people, just coming across people. Of course, in France, you know, people from all over the world. And then, of course, I remember, I always tell people, when we got to Lisbon, Portugal, one of the things that was sort of shocking, in a very good way, a fascinating way, was, I'm not sure what was happening geopolitically in 1990, but in the downtown sort of main, one of the main squares in Lisbon, there were hundreds of people from what was probably like, I mean, Angola, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Cape Verde, from Lusophone Africa. I mean, just like all of these Black people.
Hmm.
And, you know, I think when you kind of imagine, even if you have a sense of what Portugal is going to be like and look like, and, you know, Portuguese history and the, you know, racial complexities and mixtures. Stuff like, I mean, that was kind of like, oh, you know, because here you see, you know, I mean, this is like Portuguese colonialism right there in your face, you know? And so, yeah, so I think every place I've traveled, it's been, and I'm just mentioning Europe there, but I mean, going to Brazil, going to Cuba, going to Dominican Republic, I mean, all these places, I always feel like I learn something new and see something that I, you know, see aspects of the cultures that I didn't expect. To give another example, we were in Samana in the Dominican Republic, and I had read about, I'd seen, heard many years before, but then right before then had read again about the Americanos, the people who were descended from African Americans who came over on several ships, I think from several ports. One was, you know, from Philadelphia and from Savannah, and this is when Haiti and Dominican Republic were one country, and Boyer was the president. And they settled in Samana, and one of the reasons that they came down was, of course, freedom. And then, second of all, they had skills as farmers and, you know, tradespeople, etc. So their ancestors are still in Dominican Republic, and so it was really kind of fascinating to be in a place, you know, to sort of think about this really kind of complex history. It usually is alive. Now, you know, if you're in DR or you know history, this isn't so unusual. But I think, you know, for most Americans, it's just like, you know, doesn't compute at all.
Yeah.
You know, even though they may have loved, you know, baseball players who are from Samana. But I mean, just sort of things like that, you know, just sort of seeing these cultural complexities up close, experiencing them, living them. It's always, you know, I think a wonderful thing. It can be a challenge at times, but it's also, I think, something very wonderful about it, because you get a deeper sense of who you are. But, and of course, also the world itself, you know, in its complexities.
Yeah, that was going to be a question as well. Is it like, has it really, I mean, I'm sure it has impacted your own sense of identity and sense of self as an American, but I've found that it's mostly enriching, sometimes a little bit confusing,
yes.
But really, really enriching.
It definitely is enriching. And I mean, I think, you know, one of the sort of, it provided a kind of foundation for a book like Counter Narratives. I mean, there were a number of other texts that profoundly influenced that book, but just also traveling, seeing the world a little bit. You know, I mean, I've never been to Africa. I've always wanted to go, either North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa. But, you know, but just even a little bit of travel, I think, is a very, very good thing. If you can do it. I mean, not everyone can do it. It's much more expensive now to do than it was, you know, when I was younger, and even then it seemed impossibly expensive. But for every opportunity that people can, I urge it, because it helps to reset your thinking. And as you say, it is enriching even when there are challenges. Because of course you go to certain places and people, you know, don't want you there, or, you know, sometimes, or, you know, they're not so fond nowadays, particularly of America, you know, the United States. It's like, they don't want to see any person from the United States. And, you know, it also makes you think, too. It's like, because we think about, you know, European colonialism, but what about American imperialism?
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Because one of the things that also sort of fascinates me is, you know, the being in places where I'm a Black American, and I have a particular relationship with, you know, the United States, and, you know, kind of critical feelings about what it means to be a Black person here. But then you go to another country, and yes, they see I'm a Black person, but they also see immediately. I mean, I remember the first time in Brazil, I always tell people this joke of, you know, we're looking at T-shirts, and I knew immediately in Bahia that we were American, because the grande tamanho, the big size, you know. So I mean, just like, not just the face or the hair or whatever,
yeah.
But I mean, just your physical size, they know you got to be an American.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Your diet is different from right here, you know.
Definitely, I confuse people, you know, a lot with like where I might be from, but mm-hmm. when it comes down to it, they always say like, "But you're very tall." Like they know, they were
right.
they were like, "I guessed I would American or Canadian or German because you're very tall," and I was like, "Okay,
right." And then, but at the same time, and I think on that very same trip, we were in Rio de Janeiro, and, you know, I'm speaking Portuguese, and of course, you know, it had Portuguese language partners in the United States, from Paulo and Azores, to learn to read Portuguese and speak it, and it was sort of fascinating. So when I started speaking and stuff, at one point, there was one person in Rio, I think probably because the accent was more like Sao Paulo, and the person said, Paulista, you know, you're from the state of Sao Paulo. And I was like, wait a minute, I was just in one city where they knew immediately I was American, and my Portuguese, spoken Portuguese isn't even that great, but now I'm speaking Portuguese to you, and you asked me if I'm Sao Paulo, and it might have been because they heard that accent or lack of accent or something.
Yeah.
But it's sort of funny, and you think, you know, okay, so now I'm being read in a very different kind of way. I mean, it's just sort of fascinating to think about, you know, how you're read. Or I used to have long dreadlocks, and, you know, we would go to DR, you know, people, the first thing they would assume is Jamaicano, you know, are you in Jamaica?
Oh, of course, yeah.
So, you know, it's like, no, I'm not Jamaican. You know, it's like, I would smile. It's like, no, someone thinks I'm from Jamaica. It's kind of cool. You know, but so it's how you're read and how you carry yourself. It's fascinating, how these things translate or don't translate.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. I think we're going to have to wrap it up for one episode, but I would love to speak to you again.
Oh, wonderful. And thank you so much for this.
Well, that is all for this time around. I'm looking forward to diving even deeper into this conversation and seeing what other translators have to offer on this topic. Just before we got started, Keane also mentioned his work with the African Poetry Book Fund, and I highly recommend listeners check out that project, as well as read his wild and award-winning books. I was left feeling ridiculously inspired and spurred for some reason to revisit the NEA's mini-anthology, The Art of Empathy, Celebrating Literature and Translation, while waiting at a mechanic shop. Specifically, I was searching out poet and translator Gregory Pardlow's essay, Choosing a Twin, as something of my conversation with Keane was recalling ideas from that work. Translating the meanings of words is the least difficult task a poetry translator faces. It's the proverbial tip of the iceberg, he says. Taking advice from Ezra Pound's A Few Don'ts, he notes how Pound recommended poets listen deeply to poems written in languages they may not comprehend, because that way, it is easier to study the musical effects of a composition without being distracted by the poem's meaning or content. Which, while he was not talking about translators, Pardlow points out that this advice has implications for translators, even if it is talking about a poet's apprenticeship in the art. From our conversation, I was also feeling like I needed to hit the books and dive into some Italian and Portuguese as well. Speaking of learning, before signing off, I'd like to give a special invitation to any educators out there to check out our special page, Asymptote for Educators. It's under that EDU tab on the main page. There, our mission is to equip university and high school educators with the tools they need to bring literature from all over the globe into their classrooms. The world is a gloriously diverse place, and we believe all students should experience its literary, linguistic, and cultural wealth to the fullest extent possible. That's why on that education page you can find an educator's guide for every new Asymptote issue. Each guide offers a thematic breakdown of that issue's content, relevant information about the context of various pieces, and possible discussion questions and exercises. The Summer 2018 Educator's Guide is now live. Happy exploring until next time. Keep seeking out that richer and richer and richer sense of the world around you.